Chapter 12. Whose mere parting seemed to breathe upon you the fragrance of frankness and generosity, at the fastidious soul of an experienced woman. She was, before all things and all flatteries, careful of her pride in the object of her choice. But now he was actually not looking at her at all, and his expression was tense and irrational, as is natural in a man who elects to stare at nothing past a young girl's head. Well, yes. It was iniquitous. They corrupted him thoroughly, the poor old boy. Oh! Why wouldn't he let me go back to him? But now I shall know how to grapple with this. After pronouncing these words with immense assurance, he glanced down at her, and at once fell a prey to distress, incertitude, and fear. The only thing he wanted to know now, he said, was whether she did love him enough, whether she would have the courage to go with him so far away? He put these questions to her in a voice that trembled with anxiety, for he was a determined man. She did. She would. And immediately the future hostess of all the Europeans in Sulaco had the physical experience of the earth falling away from under her. It vanished completely, even to the very sound of the bell. When her feet touched the ground again, the bell was still ringing in the valley. She put her hands up to her hair, breathing quickly, and glanced up and down the stony lane. It was reassuringly empty. Meantime, Charles, stepping with one foot into a dry and moldy ditch, picked up the open parasol, which had bounded away from them with a martial sound of drum taps. He handed it to her soberly, a little crestfallen. They turned back, and after as he had slipped her hand on his arm, the first words he pronounced were, "It's lucky that we shall be able to settle in a coast town. You've heard its name. It is Sulaco. I am so glad poor father did get that house. He bought a big house there years ago, in order that there should always be a Casa Gould in the principal town of what used to be called the Occidental Province. I lived there once, as a small boy, with my dear mother, for a whole year, while poor father was away in the United States on business. You shall be the new mistress of the Casa Gould. And later, in the inhabited corner of the palazzo above the vineyards, the marble hills, the pines and olives of Lucca," he also said, "the name of Gould has been always highly respected in Sulaco. My uncle Harry was chief of the state for some time, and has left a great name amongst the first families. By this I mean the pure Creole families, who take no part in the miserable farce of governments. Uncle Harry was no adventurer. In Costaguana we Goulds are no adventurers. He was of the country, and he loved it, but he remained essentially an Englishman in his ideas. He made use of the political cry of his time. It was federation. But he was no politician. He simply stood up for social order out of pure love for rational liberty, and from his hate of oppression. There was no nonsense about him. He went to work in his own way, because it seemed right, just as I feel I must lay hold of that mine." In such words he talked to her, because his memory was very full of the country of his childhood, his heart of his life with that girl, and his mind of the San Tome concession. He added that he would have to leave her for a few days to find an American, a man from San Francisco, who was still somewhere in Europe. A few months before he had made his acquaintance in an old historic German town, situated in a mining district. The American had his womankind with him, but seemed lonely while they were sketching all day long the old doorways and the turreted corners of the medieval houses. Charles Gould had with him the inseparable companionship of the mine. The other man was interested in mining enterprises, knew something of Costaguana, and was no stranger to the name of Gould. They had talked together with some intimacy which was made possible by the difference of their ages. Charles wanted now to find that capitalist of shrewd mind and accessible character. His father's fortune in Costaguana, which he had supposed to be still considerable, seemed to have melted in the rascally crucible of revolutions. Apart from some £10,000 deposited in England, there appeared to be nothing left except the house in Sulaco, a vague right of forest exploitation in a remote and savage district, and the Santome concession, which had attended his poor father to the very brink of the grave. He explained those things. It was late when they parted. As he had never before given him such a fascinating vision of herself. All the eagerness of youth for a strange life, for great distances, for a future in which there was an air of adventure, of combat, a subtle thought of redress and conquest, had filled her with an intense excitement, which she returned to the giver with a more open and exquisite display of tenderness. He left her to walk down the hill, and directly he found himself alone he became sober. That irreparable change a death makes in the course of our daily thoughts can be felt in a vague and poignant discomfort of mind. It hurt Charles Gould to feel that never more, by no effort of will, would he be able to think of his father in the same way he used to think of him when the poor man was alive. His breathing image was no longer in his power. This consideration, closely affecting his own identity, filled his breast with a mournful and angry desire for action. And this his instinct was unerring. Action is consolatory. It is the enemy of thought, and the friend of flattering illusions. Only in the conduct of our action, can we find the sense of mastery over the fates. For his action, the mind was obviously the only field. It was imperative sometimes, to know how to disobey the solemn wishes of the dead. He resolved firmly to make his disobedience as thorough by way of atonement as it well could be. The mind had been the cause of an absurd moral disaster. Its working must be made a serious and moral success. He owed it to the dead man's memory. Such were the properly speaking emotions of Charles Gould. His thoughts ran upon the means of raising a large amount of capital in San Francisco or elsewhere, and incidentally there occurred to him also the general reflection that the counsel of the departed must be an unsound guide. Not one of them could be aware beforehand what enormous changes the death of any given individual may produce in the very aspect of the world. The latest phase in the history of the mind Mrs. Gould knew from personal experience. It was in essence the history of her married life. The mantle of the Goulds' hereditary position in Sulaco had descended amply upon her little person, but she would not allow the peculiarities of the strange garment to weigh down the vivacity of her character, which was the sign of no mere mechanical sprightliness, but of an eager intelligence. It must not be supposed that Mrs. Gould's mind was masculine. A woman with a masculine mind is not a being of superior efficiency. She is simply a phenomenon of imperfect differentiation, interestingly barren and without importance. Dona Emilia's intelligence being feminine led her to achieve the conquest of Sulaco, simply by lighting the way for her unselfishness and sympathy. She could converse charmingly, but she was not talkative. The wisdom of the heart, having no concern with the erection or demolition of theories any more than with the defense of prejudices, has no random words at its command. The words it pronounces have the value of acts of integrity, tolerance, and compassion. A woman's true tenderness, like the true virility of man, is expressed in action of a conquering kind. The ladies of Sulaco adored Mrs. Gould. "They still look upon me as something of a monster," Mrs. Gould had said pleasantly to one of the three gentlemen from San Francisco she had to entertain in her new Sulaco house just about a year after her marriage. They were her first visitors from abroad, and they had come to look at the Santome mine. She jested most agreeably, they thought, and Charles Gould, besides knowing thoroughly what he was about, had shown himself a real hustler. These facts caused them to be well disposed towards his wife. An unmistakable enthusiasm, pointed by a slight flavor of irony, made her talk of the mine absolutely fascinating to her visitors, and provoked them to grave and indulgent smiles in which there was a good deal of deference. Perhaps had they known how much she was inspired by an idealistic view of success, they would have been amazed at the state of her mind, as the Spanish-American ladies had been amazed at the tireless activity of her body. She would, in her own words, have been for them something of a monster. However, the Goulds were in essentials a reticent couple, and their guests departed without the suspicion of any other purpose, but simple profit in the working of a silver mine. Mrs. Gould had out her own carriage, with two white mules, to drive them down to the harbor, whence the Sears was to carry them off into the Olympus of plutocrats. Captain Mitchell had snatched at the occasion of leave-taking, to remark to Mrs. Gould, in a low, confidential mutter, "This marks an epoch." Mrs. Gould loved the patio of her Spanish house. A broad flight of stone steps was overlooked silently from a niche in the wall by a Madonna in blue robes with the crowned child sitting on her arm. Subdued voices ascended in the early mornings from the paved well of the quadrangle, with the stamping of horses and mules led out in pairs to drink at the cistern. A tangle of slender bamboo stems drooped its narrow, blade-like leaves over the square pool of water, and the fat coachman sat muffled upon the edge, holding lazily the ends of halters in his hand. Barefooted servants passed to and fro, issuing from dark, low doorways below, two laundry girls with baskets of washed linen, the baker with a tray of bread made for the day, Leonardo her own camarista bearing high up, swung from her hand raised above her raven-black head, a bunch of starched underskirts dazzlingly white in the slant of sunshine. Then the old porter would hobble in, sweeping the flagstones, and the house was ready for the day. All the lofty rooms on three sides of the quadrangle opened into each other and into the corridor, with its wrought iron railings and a border of flowers, whence, like the lady of the medieval castle, she could witness from above all the departures and arrivals of the casa, to which the sonorous arched gateway lent an air of stately importance. As he had watched her carriage roll away with the three guests from the north, she smiled. Their three arms went up simultaneously to their three hats. Captain Mitchell, the fourth, in attendance, had already begun a pompous discourse. Then she lingered. She lingered, approaching her face to the clusters of flowers here and there, as if to give time to her thoughts, to catch up with her slow footsteps along the straight vista of the corridor. A fringed Indian hammock from Aroa, gay with colored featherwork, had been swung judiciously in a corner that caught the early sun, for the mornings are cool in Sulaco. The cluster of Florida notched buena blazed in great masses before the open glass doors of the reception rooms. A big green parrot, brilliant like an emerald in a cage, that flashed like gold, screamed out ferociously, "Vivacosta Guana!" Then called twice mellifluously, "Leonarda! Leonarda!" in imitation of Mrs. Gould's voice, and suddenly took refuge in immobility and silence. Mrs. Gould reached the end of the gallery, and put her head through the door of her husband's room. Charles Gould, with one foot on a low wooden stool, was already strapping his spurs. He wanted to hurry back to the mine. Mrs. Gould, without coming in, glanced about the room. One tall, broad bookcase, with glass doors, was full of books, but in the other, without shelves, and lined with red baize, were arranged firearms. Winchester carbines, revolvers, a couple of shotguns, and even two pairs of double-barreled holster pistols. Between them, by itself, upon a strip of scarlet velvet, hung an old cavalry saber, once the property of Don Enrique Gould, the hero of the Occidental Province, presented by Don Jose Avellanos, the hereditary friend of the family. Otherwise, the plastered white walls were completely bare, except for a watercolor sketch of the San Tome Mountain, the work of Dona Emilia herself. In the middle of the red-tiled floor stood two long tables littered with plans and papers, a few chairs, and a glass showcase containing specimens of ore from the mine. Mrs. Gould, looking at all these things in turn, wondered aloud why the talk of these wealthy and enterprising men discussing the prospects, the working, and the safety of the mine, rendered her so impatient and uneasy, whereas she could talk of the mine by the hour with her husband with unwearied interest and satisfaction. And dropping her eyelids expressively, she added, "What do you feel about it, Charlie?" Then, surprised at her husband's silence, she raised her eyes, opened wide, as pretty as pale flowers. He had done with the spurs, and, twisting his mustache with both hands, horizontally, he contemplated her from the height of his long legs with a visible appreciation of her appearance. The consciousness of being thus contemplated pleased Mrs. Gould. "They are considerable men," he said. "I know. But have you listened to their conversation? They don't seem to have understood anything they have seen here. They have seen the mine. They have understood that to some purpose," Charles Gould interjected, in defense of the visitors. And then his wife mentioned the name of the most considerable of the three. He was considerable in finance and in industry. His name was familiar to many millions of people. He was so considerable that he would never have traveled so far away from the center of his activity if the doctors had not insisted, with veiled menaces, on his taking a long holiday. Mr. Holroyd's sense of religion, Mrs. Gould pursued, was shocked and disgusted at the tawdriness of the dressed-up saints in the cathedral, the worship, he called it, of wood and tinsel. But it seemed to me that he looked upon his own God as a sort of influential partner who gets his share of profits in the endowment of churches. That's a sort of idolatry. He told me he endowed churches every year, Charlie. No end of them, said Mr. Gould, marveling inwardly at the mobility of her physiognomy. All over the country. He's famous for that sort of munificence. Oh, he didn't boast, Mrs. Gould declared, scrupulously. Believe he's really a good man, but so stupid. A poor chulo who offers a little silver arm or leg, to thank his God for a cure's as rational and more touching. He's at the head of immense silver and iron interests, Charles Gould observed. Ah, yes. The religion of silver and iron. He's a very civil man, though he looked awfully solemn when he first saw the Madonna on the staircase, who's only wood and paint, but he said nothing to me. My dear Charlie, I heard those men talk among themselves. Can it be that they really wish to become, for an immense consideration, drawers of water and hewers of wood to all the countries and nations of the earth? A man must work to some end, Charles Gould said, vaguely. Mrs. Gould, frowning, surveyed him from head to foot. With his riding breeches, leather leggings, an article of apparel never before seen in Costaguana, a Norfolk coat of gray flannel, and those great flaming mustaches, he suggested an officer of cavalry turned gentleman farmer. This combination was gratifying to Mrs. Gould's tastes. H, how thin the poor boy is, she thought. He overworks himself. But there was no denying that his fine-drawn, keen red face, and his whole, long-limbed, lank person had an air of breeding and distinction. And Mrs. Gould relented. I only wondered what you felt, she murmured, gently. During the last few days, as it happened, Charles Gould had been kept too busy thinking twice before he spoke to have paid much. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.